Hello, everyone. Welcome to another brand new episode of the Lone Coat Mafia Podcast. It is I, the Reverend Godfather, the show's main host and frontman. And as you can tell by the shortened theme music, we're trying something a little bit different. And not to mention, before we get into the main portion of this episode, the main meat and potatoes of everything, I just want to let you know that, one, that this is a kind of a weird episode for several reasons, one of which is that this is a quasi-panel prelude slash supplementary to what happened this Saturday, October 21st, in Frederick, Maryland, at the location known as Area 31, which is, I think, a restaurant type of center. I'm not really sure, but the thing is, at this location, filmmaker, poet, Don Ramirez had a screening of his award-winning documentary titled Trailer Trash, A Film Journal. And in this episode, you'll hear not only Don Ramirez, but his sister, Sixta, hope I'm pronouncing her name right, Maria, and plus the one, the only, Earl Harrison, who came down to record this as this type of supplementary panel, promo, whatever. I just want to make sure everything's set. So, again, also, before I forget, please forgive the audio quality. It was recorded in a large ballroom-esque type environment, so therefore you're going to have what I thought would have been low audio came out just fine. So, and plus, I tried to keep it so your ears didn't get blown out with some of the odd levels that actually did work out. So I hope you enjoy everything. If you haven't seen Trailer Trash, A Film Journal, I'll put a link to the movie in the description of this episode, which you can see in Podbean. You can see it on our iTunes/Apple Podcast description, Google Play Music description, plus our Facebook description as well. So it's on YouTube, so, and it's free, so you're able to see that. It's about an hour long, give or take. So there's that. And if you have any questions, you could comment directly on YouTube. You could also comment here or email us. I'll give all that stuff out in it at the tail end of everything. So I'm going to end this because I've been rambling on long enough. And here is Don, the whole aspect and a re-intro.
Okay. Hello, folks. Welcome to a brand new episode of the Long Coat Mafia Podcast. We're doing something a little bit different right now. It's a combination of a promo thing, and this is something we were going to do on the 21st with Don Ramirez, who's with me here today. But considering that day will be a little bit hectic in reference to everything, we're recording this early, which means we'll be talking, crossing the time-space continuum in a way, and talking ahead and back and so forth and so on, which will give my co-host Big Candy a headache. Good for him. but with me here today, again, is Don Ramirez, a photographer, artist, poet,
and filmmaker.
Also with me here today, once again, fan favorite, Earl.
Hi.
Remember, this is an audio show, Earl.
Yes. Hi.
Oh, Earl could sit across the room and people
glad,
here.
Glad to be here.
And with me also is
Sixta Miranda.
Maria. And
Maria Austin.
So we're here to talk a little bit about the event that will be on the 21st of October. We're going to be giving a headache to our co-host, which I don't mind. Let him complain. About Don's award-winning, it is
award-winning documentary,
which is about 10 years, it's going on 10 years?
We're doing a special 10th anniversary screening for it.
It'll be a 10th anniversary screening of this movie. We're at Area 31.
Area 31 in downtown Frederick, Maryland. It's located on Patrick Street. Program begins promptly at 7 p.m. I'm hoping to have the doors open at 6:30.
So, depending on how things work and how I work things with my pre-recorded postful, I'll decide what I'll be posting up on Monday, so depending on how things fall. Either that will be first and this will be second. You folks at home who listen for quite a while know I'm an open book when it comes to the show, so depending on how things fall. Hopefully, if it's posted the day after, hopefully things went well. We had a great attendance. If it's before, come on out and see the show. Enjoy the show. We will be there in some form, not in this official 110-piece setup, but please, Don, tell us about the movie and the basics about it. And if there's any, I do have some notes I made a while back.
We can discuss them at the end. And again, we're going to have fun. The biggest part is the podcast that I want to do with you two after the film. We've never really done anything like that. So Earl is going to be the moderator of that. So my thought is kind of general questions, whatever you guys are comfortable sharing, you know.
You can put it down.
It's picking me up.
It's picking you up. It's picking everybody up fine for right now.
So in the beginning of the program, I'm going to set out some old cameras and different things like that. And for me, I want to make the event mostly about cinema, my love for cinema, my history as an artist in Frederick, my history as a filmmaker, the success of the film, screening in New York City at Anthology Film Archives. I found myself thinking, you know, I don't know what it was about art and why it was art and why it's that thing that came into my life, but I'm happy that it did because it's made all of the pain and all of the sacrifice and the hardships, especially the last 10 years, bearable, you know? I'm happy that I had that passion as an artist and I definitely would encourage it, but I don't know why it spoke to me. But Sixth, I want to pass this to you. What are some of the things that you would like to talk about after the show? What are some of the ideas you have that Earl should present to us? You know, I'm thinking after, like, a general impression around the day. Or how do you, you know, what are you thinking?
About what?
What kind of questions should Earl have for us to be able to sound intelligent back, you know what I'm saying? What kind of questions would you like?
I don't know. Any question.
Okay, Earl, ask us a question. Ask Sixto a question. We've just watched the film. Mm-hmm.
Sixto, it's been 10 years now. How would you express what you feel now compared to when it all started, when it happened 10 years ago?
Do you want me to answer that question?
Yeah.
Okay, so what I can express now about that is where I'm at in my head,
mm-hmm.
where I'm at with my anger, and, you know, where I was at with all of that from then to now, and where I'm at now is in a much better place.
Yeah.
You know, as to being able to have all these years to process it, and to process the things that unfolded. And, you know, even though the past 20 years, you know, substance abuse has been my field, you know, I've counseled and it's been, you know, just what I've done for 20 years. I've had things that have changed since that film, you know, and not just with that, also with mental illness. You know, I have a better understanding of things as far as addiction and mental illness when it comes to Mom and Tookie mm-hmm. and everything that unfolded. But where I'm at now, I just feel like I don't want to say that I'm at total peace now, but I have a sense of peace with just with what the film is covering. You know, I have a sense of peace with Mom, and I also have a sense of peace with Tookie,
mm-hmm.
you know, reconnecting with Tookie and just, you know, just me allowing her to come back into mm-hmm. my life.
Yes.
And being able to have her in my life without, reflecting on what happened, because I don't.
Right, yeah.
And I won't, you know. So with Tookie, I take it from today on, you know. And with all of that, I actually take it from, you know, today on. And I don't feel any more anger. You know, that's gone.
Yeah.
You know, because I was angry, you know, but that is gone. And how I'm going into this now, especially with Tookie, and you know, you doing the film 10 years later is, again, just, you know, I feel like I have processed most of this in a very healthy way, you know, and just not learning to love Tookie again, but just learning to, not even learning, but just keeping everything open for her and just allowing her to be comfortable with being around us, because that was hard for her. You know, I know you just recently saw her.
Yeah, for the first time.
Yeah, we actually talked about that today, you know. So just moving forward.
And I told Maria she was more than welcome to be here and to hear the conversation.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right. And what's important for me is that I don't take my, you know, what I don't want to relive anything that we did
right.
10 years ago, because
right.
every one of us was just angry and we were all in a mental despair, you know, and just I wasn't making good choices back then, just
right.
because
same here.
I was so fogged up with trying to find answers as to what really happened, and losing Grandma. You know, Grandma was always my foundation. She was my absolute foundation, and she kept me. She just kept me. She kept me sane. She kept me solid. You know, and that's, you know, maybe a funny thing to say for somebody that was in her 30s and she's living with her grandmother. But I can tell you what, that was probably the best 4 years of my life living with Grandma. I absolutely enjoyed it, and losing her. Just,
I want to say a few things, and then I'll throw it to Maria. Some of the things I would like to talk about, of course, and I have to. So I'm not really sure how we get the question in, but I want to talk about my divorce. I want to talk about everything that happened after that. And, you know, I want to be strong enough to share that losing my connection with my daughters was the most difficult thing I'd ever been through, and it's what it broke me, you know. So I have all these friends in Frederick who would be coming to the screening, and I mean, I've been hiding under a fucking rock since 2010, but that's the reason, you know. So coming to some kind of understanding that, you know, I cannot change this thing. I can only hope for a brighter tomorrow.
Right.
Which is ultimately the whole message that, you know, goes on in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at it as, you know, I was broken with losing Grandma, with everything that happened. And I really remember things beginning to unravel with Carla when I came home from New York City, from the screening in New York City. And that was kind of marked the beginning of the end of our marriage.
Yeah.
And just the evil fucking shit that she did. I don't want to talk about that because I don't want to conjure.
No, I was there to witness that.
Her up. But, you know, I definitely need to say that loss, you know, is what really broke me. You know, and I was broken.
Like a domino.
And it, yeah. And it's I remember having a discussion too with you when you had said that you had been through your divorce, that you know, it'd be 5 years before you're back on your feet.
Yeah.
Right. But I'll throw it to Maria. What are some of the, if for Earl to kind of have a way into what you're thinking, what would you like to say?
Well, that's a little bit tricky because I'm more of a closed book. So I'm not as revealing as Sixta. But I would just say, maybe just talking about the process, like when you were doing the film, because I was telling a friend last night, someone had mentioned your brother's film about the murder. And so I had to set him straight that it started as a journal because
right.
we are a family that was losing a grandmother to
right.
cancer. That's
right.
what started
right.
this documentary.
Right. When this part of it will go out, and it's not against you or Earl, just to clarify things with Don,
well, this way so it gets me a little bit better. I'll get into all that with have Don answer those questions because he was the main person behind it.
Right.
So, and I don't want to dig up again, not against you, his family, and all that, because again, this was Don's baby when he first started doing this 10 years ago. I don't want to dig up any soil, you know, with the bigger Ramirez family, so to speak. That way, whatever discussion we could have, it's getting, you know, so forth and so on. And with this panel that, with Earl being the moderator, which I'm happy Earl is the moderator. Donna couldn't have fit fine.
I'll tell you, too, Earl's history with our family goes back. I mean, he presided over my grandmother's funeral, mom's funeral, and then he was a speaker when we presented the film Trailer Trash, a film journal at Shepherd in March of 2007. Presented to a huge audience. Yeah. It was standing room only, over 500 people. The film itself screened in 22 different film festivals. We were in a program put together by John Waters in Sydney, Australia. We screened in England a couple of times, Three Rivers Film Festival in Pittsburgh, won Best Documentary at Rosebud. So, I mean, there's the film itself got a lot of critical acclaim. You know, it did real well. It reached the largest audience I'd ever reached.
My recommendation for you, granted, Earl and Don have, and myself have been in some form and to some extent in front of various numbers of people. The best thing I could tell you when you're in that panel is to relax at all costs, because you're going to be shaking. That first time out is going to be like being in an accident. And that's the best analogy I can explain, because you're going to be, you could be calm, cool, and collect when you're going into it. When you're coming out of it, that adrenaline is going to smack you in the face, and you're going to be literally like shaking like a leaf in a hurricane.
We sat in front of a panel before. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've done this.
We were on the panel.
Right, we've done this, but it was back
question?
To yeah, absolutely.
Mia, tell me if it's out of bounds, but Alexander was young when this happened.
Four,
mm-hmm. And so has there been a need to explain to him, to help him to deal with it? I mean, as a mom,
I'm very open, and he's a very sensitive child, and I mean, he's 17 now, but I have been very open about, you know, D's film and just what the family went through. Mm-hmm. He remembers Grandma going through that. He has a very short memory. At 4 years old, I mean,
yeah. Right.
So he remembers Grandma, mm-hmm. You know, laying in that bed and mm-hmm. the group pictures, and he remembers that.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not ready to see the movie, because I did talk to him about that.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not ready. So when he's ready, it's there.
So is that a question I could ask?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
I think that's a great question.
Yeah, me too.
Mm-hmm.
See how it's impacted, you know, the children after you all, you know, the next generation and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, I'd be perfectly
because oftentimes, I think that children, our loved ones, can be an extension. They feel our pain, and mm-hmm. so they're acting out and they're displaying things that maybe they might not even know the reason why, but they tap into our hurt, our pain, our anger.
Something I tell Sixta is, because I moved back to Delaware, I was in Delaware
mm-hmm.
When the film was completed, and I remember we all felt this way. I mean, I just felt just despair at some point in time. And I remember being at the pool, and I was thinking about everything that was going on, everything, what happened afterwards, during. And I remember, like, I was just thinking to myself, I just wanted to die. I just truly at some point in time felt like that. And I was in this fog. I'll never forget, I was in this fog. Everything went quiet, and I was like, how am I going to do it? Then all of a sudden, I feel this. And it was Alexander. And he's like, Mom. And I was like, oh, my gosh, I love my son so much. And I literally wrote a poem, and it said, you saved my life that day.
Right.
You still have it?
I do. I would have to dig it out. And I told Alexander about that when he was about 15 years old, when I felt that he could handle that.
One of the strange realities that comes for me is when the actual filming stopped.
Right.
When that creative process was gone for me. And now I've got to deal with, you know, this home life that was no longer having that buffer in between me and reality that you know,
right,
that was a
that was one thing,
it,
yeah,
it took an adjustment
process, yeah.
It took an adjustment.
Well, Don, do you think that the experience, you know, we can have those seminal moments or something that we pour so much of ourselves into, like your film, and I know you poured yourself into it, did it leave you at the end, and even though you were experiencing the highs and success in the film festivals and all that, was there an empty and a bankruptcy inside of yourself to where you didn't want to do art anymore?
That's an interesting question. And it's a complicated one to answer about stepping away from art and not wanting to... I can only say I connected to the loss of my kids. Like, I feel like I shouldn't be able to enjoy making an art. So I've decided that of the one thing that I've got to sacrifice to remind me of this larger sacrifice is not pursuing art. But also, like, I mean, the last stuff I was doing, you know, I really mentally was out there. And it was like a gravity's rainbow kind of period where, you know, and I knew if I didn't get out of that, I would never get out of that. So I had to shut that door for now, and I had to get out of that. I was too deep. I love the work that came from that period. I love the ideas that came from that. And maybe sometime in the future I would have an opportunity to explore them, but I need the objectivity I've always had as an artist to be able to explore those things, and I'm not there.
Was it a dark place?
Very dark place. Very dark place, and one that's just an incredible blur, you know. I mean, I felt like I was Osama bin Laden at Tora Bora, and I got my ass fucking kicked, and I climbed in a fucking cave until people stopped bombing.
Right, did
you have to retreat to survive?
Absolutely. To hope to fight again someday, you know. I mean, that's just the reality of it. I had to quit. I had to... The war that was going on between me and Carla was just, you know, absolutely convinced that all this stuff... I mean, I lost my career, for crying out loud. I lost my entire fucking career. I had to literally reinvent myself at middle age.
Are you still Don Diego?
I'm not Don Diego. I think of him fondly. I don't know that there won't be another point where I would use that name again as an artist, but I'm Don Ramirez now. I'm just this blue-collar guy. Tomorrow I'm going to be staying in a fucking house in Berkeley Springs. But that life is bearable because of this earlier life I lived as an artist.
How important has it been, the connection between you three? You
know, it's the only thing that keeps me going.
Yeah, family.
We're very close, and we've always been close, you know. But I think it's almost hard to say that it brought us even closer, because we really, truly have always been that close. We have been, you know, and the way, especially the way Grandma raised us, you know, how to respect one another. I don't even know if we needed that. The love was there, and the love is still there, you know, and I think we're very careful with our minds, with each other's minds, and what we put into each other's minds and what we put on each other. You know, Marie and I are very private people, and we respect that to this day. And we're very careful as to what we put on each other, you know. And the same thing with Dee. But we've only gotten stronger, and we've only gotten closer, which is silly for me to say, because we are and always have been that close. I mean, the love here, you know, Earl.
Yeah,
I mean,
do.
It's deep, deep, deep love.
To be a part of it.
Yeah, very deep love. And I tell people when they ask me about my brother, I'm in love with my brother. I just don't love him. I'm in love with my brother.
Yes.
I'm in love with my twin.
Yes.
And I said the same thing about my mother. I was in love with Mom. You know.
And when you love somebody that much, when you really love somebody like that, you really can see that person, every bit of that person, and you know what, you know when you're overstepping boundaries, you know everything, you know, and we're just careful with one another, you know. And Dee, I know that you being so silent about what, you know, that crazy ass put you through, because I witnessed some of that shit and I became a little piece of that.
Right.
And just you being so quiet, I had to respect that as well. Because me and Deglia and Maya, we were so close. And when this happened, I felt like I lost.
You did.
You know, me and Deglia were like that. Yeah. You know, and the photographs, I was looking at a photograph of her today. I cannot look at a photograph of Deglia without losing it, because I miss her that much.
The one thing I want to share, and I would share with the audience, is I've done this. I've kept this, my wedding band, with me every single day. And I hope to give it to Deglia at some point to let her know I never stopped forgetting, you know, thinking about it. That this was not what I wanted. It's the reality of what happened. You know, and I think it's horrible that, you know, you get to that level of conflict with another human being that, you know. But I'm not the only person that goes through shit like that.
No,
unfortunately,
you know,
I'm not the only one.
With Deglia and with
Yamaya,
they're half of Don Diego. And that gives me comfort, because if they're half of Don Diego Ramirez, then, you know, that's Sixta, that's Maria, that's Grandma, that's Donna, that's your side of the family. And that tells me that the compassion and just what they have in their heart. They have traits that, you know, that it'll come out later on in their years where, mm-hmm. Will they reach out? We haven't lost those two, you know, just physically they're not here, you know. But Deglia has just what she has imprinted on my brain and my heart is just, I couldn't even describe it, you know. I just fell in love.
That'll be the hardest part of watching the film for me is looking at the kids.
Right.
So I haven't watched the film in many years.
Yeah, that was my next question. Yeah. Have you all viewed it since?
The last time I saw it was a night that I didn't see it, because, you know, I had one too many.
Three sheets.
So I had like probably five beers, feeling melancholy. And the worst thing you can do is pop in Trailer Trash.
Exactly.
And, oh, my God, I remember crying my ass off and just, oh, man. But so I did see it, and I saw it in 2015.
Mm. I watch it once a year. Mm. Yeah, I pop
do
in.
Do you really? Wow.
I sure do.
That's heavy.
I do.
That's heavy.
You know, just, and I don't know why I do. I just have my moments where I just, you know, I'll just put it in. And sometimes I will make it all the way through, and most of the times I don't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it also, for me, seeing that movie, it's a chance to hear Grandma's voice.
Yeah, yeah. That's another thing is to see.
And I was thinking about what you were saying, too, about Grandma, because I think about, you know, coming back to some level of normalcy, some level of being able to put one foot in front of the other because of her, because of her strength. And, you know, she suffered her pains in life. She bore her crosses, but she did them with, you know, quiet dignity.
Very
she was an incredibly
dignity.
Strong
yeah.
woman. And you knew that there was a lot of pain in her life. There was a lot of pain in her character. But, you know, that she was always, this is what is right.
Right.
And that, you know, to have that moral compass, you know, I'm very fortunate, you know, for the chaos that we had grown up with, you know, poverty in the neighborhood. But to have some idea of what's the difference between right and wrong. I might not have always chose right. You know what I'm saying? I knew I was choosing wrong because of Grandma, but I still made my choice.
Me and Andy will talk for hours just about, you know, Grandma and just, you know, some of the things that she instilled, but some of the shit that she tolerated quietly with us, you know.
Right.
And I always go back to that one night when me and you stayed with her. I think we were there for 4 days together. And here we are in our mid-20s, and we're saying shit back and forth
itty,
to each
bitty,
other.
Titty, committee.
Right, at 3 o'clock in the morning, and here's Grandma yelling at us, and we're in our mid-20s. If I have to come out there, and if I have to say, then we start busting out laughing. Then we give her like 15 minutes of silence, and then we start up again. And then here comes Grandma out like at 3 o'clock in the morning, hollering at me and Dee like we're kids. We loved it.
So So I'm pretty comfortable. I think that we're all on the same page on, you know, we'll just do questions like this, you know.
Yeah.
At the end of it, we might throw in a little questions from the audience kind of thing.
Yeah, it's hard to suggest questions because you're just...
Right. You'll just have to let the conversation, just general
organically
questions.
Organically.
I can tell you what's important for me personally is I, you know, as far as Christopher and Christina... For my heart and for me right now, I just feel like I want to keep them a little bit private right now. I think, you know, there's struggles.
I would defer all questions about the larger family to you guys anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I have no problem with acknowledging that I've become progressively more emotionally unavailable.
Right.
And that's just, you know, I like it that way. My life is like an episode of The Walking Dead, and everybody's fucking Negan to me.
Right. You know? You're stupid.
I don't want Lucille upside my head.
Oh,
Lucille.
My God. I
don't know any of these characters.
I try to keep everyone, you know, fairly at bay.
And I know that people, I'm sure, would be curious as to, you know, how we are today. You know, so...
I don't mean to intrude or anything like that.
Yeah, I only have three. I told Donna, I didn't expect to have the multitude of people here today. I'm happy to see all of you, including Earl, whose nose is buried deep in his book. because one of the things... I only bring it up because kind of Don brought it up... And because it's been so long, you know, where has, not so much the time gone, but what happened, it's easier for Don to kind of, even though you got, both of you kind of covered what happened afterwards, but kind of what happened afterwards that you're willing to get into. I'm sure even I'll get into it with Don a little bit later, but in reference to the details, what, you know, this obviously was a shake up in the family with what Tuk did and everything else. Some of it, again, I'll get in with Don and what he's willing to provide. Again, with this, be prepared to a little bit of the questions that kind of like Lucille will whack you inside of the head that you don't want. I think, let's see.
Can I throw one question, Adam?
Okay. Go ahead.
The one thing I was thinking about, the house. What are your memories of the house in Shenandoah Junction? How do you think of that? I know I only went back, I've only been back one time since I lost the house in foreclosure. And so much of the film is centered around that house. And, you know, we had it for almost a decade or something. You know, I bought it to take care of Grandma. It's hard for me to go back because I feel very much... And when I tried to live in the house after my divorce, haunted. Mm-hmm. It was haunted, you know, that I thought and remembered the house so fondly and such great memories.
Yes.
And to not have that, to realize this is all gone, you know, the house felt very haunted. And,
right.
And I didn't want to be there.
I drive by the house all the time.
Do you?
I do. And I just do that just, you know, this is going to sound silly for you know me, it's just... You know, I think Grandma's spirit is there. You put some of her ashes in her flower garden. I never know what I might feel when I drive by there,
or
like what I might see when I drive by there. You know how I am. You know, I have. I feel like I have this, you know, kind of crazy connection with the afterlife. You know, and just
it's the spirit realm.
Yeah, and
your
the spirit realm. Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, and I believe that Grandma is all around us, and I drive by there just for the memories. I need to feel it.
And you and I mean, we gave her that.
Yes,
we
did.
You know, we dealt with that, and, you know, it's in the film, you know, we forget about some of the details in the film, but the trailer park had been bought, and she was going to be homeless. She didn't have nowhere to go. She didn't know what she was going to do. She was a little desperate, so I bought a house. I bought a little house in Shenandoah Junction and paid that mortgage for what felt like forever, and lost it in the Great Recession when I lost everything else. But we did that together.
Yes. And that was a feel-good thing, too, because Grandma got to travel. I mean, there's a lot of things that she was able to do.
And she was happy.
And she was happy.
She was happy.
Yes.
And I like grandma yelling at me like I was a 10-year-old girl in my 30s. I fucking loved it, you know. So that's just me. But, you know, I do sometimes like to revisit some of the pain that I experienced, you know, in the past. And sometimes I need to see some of that to, you know, to get into it a little bit more. And it's not that I need to be reminded of what gave me the pain, but that only made me stronger.
Right.
You know, I went through a little bit of shit, too. You know, we all did after this. You know, fuck, I was crazy in my head for a moment. I was one angry person. And my car, and go in the inside of my car, you know, I would see a budget rental truck go by me, and I would have a complete meltdown because I think of Granddad, you know, his body being in that truck. And I would pull over, and I would either beat the shit out of my car. If I was near water, I would go down to the water, and I would literally scream to the top of my head. I mean, scream like I was rabid. I'd have, you know, just slobber come, you know, just falling out of me. Mm-hmm. And I would just follow it through. And I would, during that crazy-ass process, you know, of me going through that, you know, so many things would fill me and so many things would leave me, and I would just feel so good after that. I know that sounds crazy, but I felt so good after that.
Here's another little side thing that I ask about. Mary, when we went up and we saw the gravesite where Granddad had been buried in Jaredstown, we met Mary and her daughter. I can't remember. What was the daughter's name?
For some reason, I thought.
But you remember Mary and Tony.
Tony.
Now, you know she disappeared.
Yes.
Mary. And I've always believed that she was murdered.
Yeah.
But I don't know that for a fact, and neither do any of the authorities, but she's never, they've never found out
yeah,
what happened.
Yeah, that was odd. I do remember that.
That happened about 3, 4, maybe 5 years ago. I was working at FedEx when that happened.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So she's in my film. She's the, you know, she's part of the story. Yes.
Don, this was started out as, Sixta Maria said, as a documentary, documenting, you know, the process of your grandmother's fight with cancer, that process.
It started with, we found out that she had cancer. Mm-hmm. Carla was pregnant. Mm-hmm. I borrowed a Canon 512, a nice little Super 8 camera from a friend of mine, and shot one single roll of film, like the day we found out that she had terminal cancer. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning. That from there, the idea was just to kind of film her decline and to film Carla being pregnant. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe a short film out of it.
And so, you know, you started out with that. That was the motivation, you know, behind it. But it turned, evolved into something totally different. What would be your hope for Trailer Trash? What would you, other than, you know, you...
For me to feel like with this podcast, like it's done, it's concluded.
Some closure?
I've always, very much some closure. I'll keep all of the source material, all of the original material, and if there was ever a filmmaker that had the resources to be able to explore it. Mm-hmm. You know, I made the film on fucking jump change, $1,500. You know, mm-hmm. we're up against films that have, you know, budgets of tens of thousands of dollars. You know,
right.
We made it humbly. You know, three of us worked on it laboriously for about a year. Mm-hmm. I filmed for, I think it's almost 2 years that I filmed and collected all the original source material. And then Dave Wonger and Ben and I are the ones that eventually brought it down to the film that you saw tonight.
Even with all the pain, the loss, the hurt, all the things that are involved in Trailer Trash, the story, do you believe that good is coming out of it? Do you believe that good has?
Yes.
That it has impacted lives, that... Okay.
On YouTube, we have nearly 30,000 views. Mm-hmm. You know, that since making the film, we've done no kind of social document, no nothing like this. So that was one of the reasons that I wanted to do the screening and to do the podcast, mm-hmm. so we could at least be able to talk about it. But yes, mm-hmm. I do believe that, like the original film, it is very much the cautionary tale. It's a tale of love. It's a tale of humanity. It's a tale as intriguing as anything William Shakespeare would have written.
It's got all of it. Yeah.
So it tells you, you know, from the lowest, from the lowest to the highest, the things that make us human. They're all universal. There's nothing that really separates you as a human being from one group or another, that it's shared experience.
Yes.
Yeah, I believe that there's good in the film. Mm-hmm. I believe that the ultimate message and why the film was so well received is because it has a positive message.
Okay,
it does have a positive message, and I think anybody who meets the three of us also feels the same way, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think for me personally, if I were to, you know, use one word to describe that film, it would be love. And I know that, you know, might be like, what, but it took a lot of love, first of all, for you to do what you had to do and what you did do.
Yes.
And it also took a lot of love for us to go through this, the during and the after.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a very difficult time watching my grandmother pass away. And Maria said something to me one day. We were on the phone. And, you know, she says, Six, it's just like we're all waiting for her to die. And meaning that that day's going to come, you know. But I had a very, very difficult moment during that. And to come out of that moment, you know what I'm talking about, you know, to come out of that, you know. But I think this movie, to me, it's about love, you know, because we all could be hating on each other right now for whatever whatever reason, and we don't. And I do not let anybody who does not know me, you know, think otherwise. You know, we fucking love each other, you know. And that film is about love. It's about love and struggle. And we were real about it. And we were raw about it. And we were open about it. Don was open about it. You know, that's you know, love and strength.
And one of the things that I have seen in your family is that there is so much light.
Yes.
So much charisma. You know, each one of you all that I know, you generate that. And one of the things that people, we are preoccupied, almost morbidly so, with death. And a lot of people are afraid of death. And you all experienced it, your mom, your grandmother, your grandfather. Has your perception or the way that you view death, has it changed through that process? Or
Shooting her death was really hard, shooting those last scenes. But I remember having this conversation with Grandma when I was in college. And, you know, we had a strange relationship when I was younger, crazy punk rock days. But I had a class called Death and Dying, and I remember discussing some of the ideas that was presented in that class with her. And it was the first time that I really realized that you have to prepare. You have to prepare to die. And she had prepared herself, and this years before she would, but, you know, she knew what was important to her. She knew what her beliefs would be when she died, you know, what happened after, all that kind of stuff. But she was resolved, but she was also, you know, the idea of, she was resolved that you live life to the end. You know, that her Catholicism, her faith, all those kind of things. But she spoke to me with great clarity, and that, you know, great clarity. She was very clear. And I found a little, like, wow, you know. And I think that was the first time for me, as a young person, that I began to think, well, I guess I have to think about that, too. You know what I mean?
And watching the way that she went through it, I guess I would imagine, you know, me watching my mom, her knowing that she was going to die, and being there with her, you know, watching her as she did it with the grace that she did it with, you know, and
that she did do with grace, she did.
I think to be there too with people that you love when they pass, it's an experience that's hard to put into words. I mean, you want that. I want that. Everyone should want that.
That
you know, you should want to be surrounded by people who love and cherish you.
Were you all there when she passed?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
We were there when she
three of us.
That is what I miss with my mom, to hold her hand, to be with her as she made that passage. What was that like? Was it, now that you look back at it, you know, I know there were a lot of emotions involved at the moment, the sorrow, the sadness, and all that, but does it give you anything knowing that you were there with her?
It definitely gives you some comfort, because I have completely different feeling of how I still handled my mom's death versus my grandmother. Mm-hmm. There is some closure mm-hmm. when you're there mm-hmm. day after day, and there's a huge difference in mm-hmm. like the way you lost your mom, like with mm-hmm. the way we lost our mother. Mm-hmm. I still emotionally just a yeah. wreck over that.
Yeah, because I couldn't say goodbye.
Right, you can't yeah. say goodbye. Yeah. And so with grandma, there was an answer. We knew what it was, mm-hmm. and then to have mm-hmm. some closure and spend time with her. So mm-hmm. it makes it a little easier, mm-hmm. a little easier.
Mm-hmm. For me, it made me very accepting of with mom's passing, you know, of death. Mm-hmm. You know, and I tell people, mom passed, she opened my gates to heaven, mm-hmm. and you know, I don't fear death mm-hmm. maybe the way most people do. I just don't. Mm-hmm. You know, when I get to see grandma and mom again, mm-hmm. you know, I'm looking forward to that day. Mm-hmm. And however that happens, that mm-hmm. happens. Right. But I believe in spiritually that there'll be some kind of reconnection. Mm-hmm. You know, so both of their deaths made me, you know, fear of death even less and less. And, you know, the way...
I wish it had that impact on me, but it didn't. I'm still...
For me, it's, you know...
Still not ready?
No.
Just accepting. I know that's the one thing that is. And my thing is, if my grandmother can die and lose a little bit of her life every single day, mm-hmm. you know, when she was given her prognosis, mm-hmm. and she did it so fucking gracefully. She really did.
Yeah.
That right there, I'm thinking, okay. And I know that... Part of grandma was scared because she told me so.
Yeah.
You know, and there's some things that she talked about and some things she didn't want to talk mm-hmm. about. You know, but just watching her, you know, that's what made me just, you know, not be afraid. Because she was facing it every day.
Right.
She mm-hmm. was facing it, mm-hmm. you know. And,
yeah,
and
there's
that's,
no vacation.
There's no vacation. There's no walking backwards. There's no mm-hmm. coming out of it, you know. So I think ultimately she prepared us in some way mm-hmm. for our own demise, you mm-hmm. know, whenever... That may happen, you know, if we get diagnosed with something. I don't know. I'm just not afraid of death. I'm just
right.
not.
Yeah, me neither.
You know.
There's subtle things in the film, many subtle things, but one of the funny things that's subtly in there is talking to her, and she's talking about Henry, our grandfather, who had given her crap.
The STDs or the crap.
And she says it on you know, here's this 82-year-old woman going, he gave me crap! You know? And... Despite, you know, as serious as we talk about my grandmother, she had an incredible sense of humor.
She did.
She was a wonderful person to just be around. You
oh,
know,
my
she
God,
was
the shit you used to do to her, how you used to torture that woman.
Are you guys good? You know, y'all want to go?
And so,
we've got
I'm very
this,
comfortable
and then
with
Chris and
with
I can talk
this.
For a while.
Yeah.
Do you have any questions you want to ask them?
I'll put it like this. With what I asked Don, if that's something kind of...
relates a little bit and you feel like you want to chime in, feel free to do so, because some of the questions I might have could maybe you could fill in better than Don could. I'm not
guys
not
welcome
Don.
To stay around.
So yeah, you are welcome.
The one
stay.
Thing we'll go over real quick, like the program will begin around 7. Oh, we're supposed to go Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
Nick,
okay.
Yeah, I asked. I left them a voicemail mm-hmm. and rescheduled it to Tuesday. We're going to meet with Area 31 for the last little prep.
Mm-hmm.
But
so Tuesday,
what
time are we going?
We're going to leave Nick's at 5 and be over there at 6.
Okay.
So he's supposed to pick you and I up and drop
okay.
us back off.
Okay.
I'm going back and forth on whether or not I'm going to show this bumper. It's a trailer that Craig Smith had made for, I think it was 2006, Frederick Film Festival. I'll probably end up screening it. Earl, introduce everything. The first speaker is a woman named Becky Mersch-Lachlan. She's an artist from Frederick I've known since the early 90s. Got a great relationship, fantastic woman. She's going to introduce and talk about me as an artist in Frederick and the different things that I did. Also invited Craig Smith, who I think you guys have met a few times, to be part of the program. Craig and I taught a filmmaking workshop mm-hmm. in Frederick, Maryland in 1995. Becky was in that class. So got a good connection there. I got limited editions of my book. I have 25 copies of my book. Got them all in cellophane. I'm putting special inserts in it. I did 25 copies of a Steve Blickenstaff image that we use for T-shirts in 95 for a workshop. So if you don't know who Steve Blickenstaff is, famous Frederick artist, did the Cramps cover Bad Music for Bad People. Really neat image maker. And I'm thinking about putting a couple of limited edition prints in there too. Do you still have the one of the butterfly wing? Do you have that?
That's mine.
You have that? If I need to, can I borrow it back? Or I wanted to copy it. I might get that from you.
You won't get it back.
Yeah, you will. And the DVD. They're in better. And that first cop, the first DVD you had was all raw footage. So I'm going to keep that.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
Okay.
Upstairs on the second floor, I don't know what kind of, you know. I mean, you can pee in the toilet and you can sit there for 6 months.
Risk.
We're at the Art Center in Martinsburg. So I'll let Craig talk. I want to talk a lot about, you know, filmmaking and some of my heroes. So I'm going to go ahead and do that, Chris.
Okay.
Because I was trying to decide on how I could best tie this all together to be able to talk to you, younger filmmakers. And I thought the one thing I could do that really ties everything together is to start with my hero, Lenny Lipton. Lenny Lipton, if you have seen a 3D film in your local cinema, if you've seen Avatar, Star Wars, anything on 3D, this guy, Lenny Lipton, is the chief technology officer of Real-D. He designed all the 3D cameras and projection systems that are being used today in your cinemas. But this guy is a pioneer. He dates back to the late 60s, and I'm going to talk about him for quite some time.
And just a little bit, again, I'm not going to bite, and since Earl's not here, not knocking Earl in any way, shape, or form, you two could scooch a little bit closer if you want. The mics do not bite.
You mean now?
Yeah, go ahead. Don't worry.
Chris isn't biting before the
conversation.
Yeah, the conversation's always been here, so no worries.
All right.
So.
Okay.
If you got to go, just.
Yeah, I have to go pick up my son and his friend and get them back to this area. So getting back to Shepherdstown.
It's been nice being a part of this discussion with you.
Thank you for having me.
When everything does drop, Don will be the first to know, and I'm sure he'll get the word out to you and the rest of the family that this is out.
Absolutely.
So,
I can't wait to hear it.
So, it is nice to have you.
You
too.
You're going to stick around? All right. For a little bit, anyway.
Okay.
We'll go for a little bit longer.
Okay. Yeah.
Chris, any questions you got for me? Feel free, my friend.
Okay.
You put up with us
long. I love you.
Even though you talked about a lot of even what I have in my show notes from when I watched it, because I was watching it, I was jotting stuff down. First off, because the movie seemed to have several different styles of, I won't say filming, I could say filming styles, because it seemed like in some instances it had that 8mm style, in other instances it had it like a someone recording with like a VHS, RCA, handheld, and other times you had in this film clips from local news establishments, obviously because it is a documentary. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, why those different styles?
Okay, excellent question. Really good question, Chris. My evolution as a filmmaker, I'm part of a little bit of an older generation, and I was fortunate enough to still shoot movie film when I came of age. In 1993, I was at UMBC taking a film 101, and I was taught on a 16mm camera called a Bolex. My buddy Craig Smith is the one that turned me on to Super 8, and I quickly became fascinated and fell in love with Super 8. Now, Super 8 stopped being part of the mainstream in 1985, so by the time I was being introduced to it in the early 90s, you would have thought that it was dead and gone, but it survived, and it continues to survive to this very day. Kodak still makes 5 different Super 8 film stocks. And I would encourage this younger digital generation to have an analog experience, to shoot a little bit of Super 8 film or 16mm film,
because I don't believe it'll be around forever. I hope that, like other art mediums, it gets passed from one generation to another. But my heroes have always been underground filmmakers. When I was making Trailer Trash, I was actually teaching at Shepherd, and I taught a class called Survey of American Avant-Garde Film. And that's always been the movement that I'm most fascinated by as a filmmaker. Always want to know about the avant-garde. But institutions like Canyon Cinema Cooperative in California and Anthology Film Archives are two institutions that have helped to really preserve that aesthetic that I was introduced to in film school. So I tried to draw on my film heroes and put their ideas in my film. And I think that that's one of the reasons that it did well. And it's strange, like, now to look back, hand-holding a camera was considered, you know, taboo when I made Trailer Trash. But now it's commonplace. If you watch The Walking Dead, there's a lot of handheld cameras because cameras are lighter and easier. So I can see that evolutionary change. I can see the ideas that get started in underground film making their way into mainstream cinema. But I looked at Trailer Trash in every conceivable way as what's called an underground film, from the methods that I used and to the fact that I had no budget. You know, I mean, I made the film on chump change. But I used mostly Super 8 film, and I recorded the sound very old school. I think we had a cheap just recorder.
You did.
Yeah, it was literally just cassette recorders. I still have all the cassettes. Then we would have to transfer all of that source material, the Super 8 film and the audio tapes, into a digital format, and all the editing was done digitally using Macintosh. David Wonger did all the editing, did a fantastic job of it. But I started using the digital video after we found out what had happened to my grandfather, because I needed a way to be able to record, you know, audio. So that's when I started mixing in the digital, and it was called digital video now. I don't even know what the fuck they shoot now.
Another quick question. I'm sure you'll probably get this question as well in the panel that you will have. Why the title Trailer Trash?
That's a good one. That's a good one. I forget exactly how I say it, but I think it's something like Trailer Trash, how I've grown to hate those two words. It reduces all that you are and all those you love into nothingness. I wanted to use that term because it was used against us poor kids in a derogatory way, you know. But I wanted to say with that, you know, no one's trash. No life is meaningless. No one is to be discarded. So you get this fascinating story. And like we had said earlier, the drama inside of the film is almost Shakespearean. So it makes you think, you know, a little bit more with the title Trailer Trash. And I knew it would actually catch people's attention when I submitted it to a film festival. I'm doing things that are intentional. This is going to catch people's attention. Trailer Trash. What the fuck is this, you know? And it's funny, when it screened, when we won Best Documentary, we were part of the New Jersey Film Festival, in a film festival at Rutgers University. We won Best Documentary at the United States Super 8 Film Festival in 2007. Won Best Documentary at Rosebud 2007 in Washington, D.C., but this guy named Alan Nigan, who's the head of the film festival and the film program in New Jersey, he said that the students picked that film out of all the submissions just on the title and popped it in and watched it beginning to end. Wow. He said, I knew at that moment you were in the festival, because they'd pop a video in, they'd watch a couple of minutes of it, pop it out. But they said that from the minute they put it in, four or five of them sat right there and watched the whole film beginning.
As you said earlier in this recording, that this was intended primarily to be your grandmother's story, you know, from beginning to end. So for those who have not watched it on YouTube yet, it is on, I must say, this is on YouTube. I'll provide a link to the movie in the description that you guys or gals could click on and
absolutely
and watch at your leisure on YouTube.
Less than an hour. Less than 53 minutes.
53 minutes.
So it did start, the initial point of the document was her journey of having cancer. So it was initially going to be that, as you said, a short film.
My first thought were, you know, a short film because my wife at the time, Carla, was pregnant. So I thought, you know, this heavy experience of this woman I love, you know, my grandmother leaving and my daughter being born. So my first thought was, let me see what, you know, comes of this. And I started shooting film just based on that idea. And then it's after my grandmother passes that we find out everything with my grandfather, and it just changed the whole structure. And at that point, all I knew I needed to do was just keep filming.
Well, that's one thing. I think the both of you kind of touched on this, and that's one of the things I wanted to ask, is because around the 12, 13-minute mark, it seemed a little hard to watch because it seemed like you actually filmed your grandmother's passing. I'm going to state this as I stated with Earl with his recording. You do not have to answer if you so wish. Did you film her passing?
I did film it. Absolutely, I filmed it. And, you know, I had discussed it with her afterwards. It's one of the toughest scenes in the film to watch. I thought it's important because I wanted to show what the disease had done to her, being sick with cancer. I wanted to show how fragile she was. And I thought, you know, everyone needs to see what death looks like up close and personal. I want to talk about that scene for a minute.
Go ahead.
The hardest part, like, I had to go back in these cassette tapes I'm talking about, and I had to find the moment that she dies in the cassette tape. And I remember I was working at Grafton at the time, and I would listen to the tapes on my ride home, bawling, just fucking bawling, trying to go back and forth in these tapes and find that one specific, you know. And that when her air compressor, the oxygen thing goes up, and it's just, you know. But I follow that up with an homage where at the moment of her death, you go into this lap dissolve sequence and you see me with my grandmother at her side from childhood to the end, you know. But I paid homage to this one filmmaker, a guy named James Broughton. I screened his film here at the Art Center for my 50th birthday, this amazing little short film called Testament. And it was a film that had spoke to me in 1993 when I first saw it. James Broughton is a phenomenal filmmaker, a phenomenal poet. But it is about that, your life and death and, you know, coming to the end. It's just an elegant film that talks about death and dying. And I wanted to very much thank James Broughton, if that makes sense, for helping me to understand and see things a little bit differently. But all through the film, I do everything I can to acknowledge the filmmakers who have come before me that I've admired, you know, figures that most people don't even know their names. But they're the real filmmakers that shape the cinema that we see today.
And one of the things I found kind of, even though I'm kind of explaining to those at home who have not seen the movie yet, from, it seems, within about 24 hours of your grandmother's passing, it transitions to the murder of your grandfather. What caught my eye and ear is that your grandma seemed to predict this in a way.
Yeah.
It's strange. I think about that, you know, yes. And I'm a pretty avowed atheist. I'm not, you know, I'm not a religious person. I'm not a believer. But that there was the universe offered Grandma some level of, she died before she knew of what was going on. There was some premonition. My grandma had always had that kind of bullshit. I don't know how to explain it.
She did.
But she had always had these, you know...
premonitions.
Yeah, I mean, I can't describe it. I have no scientific, you know, but when... Yeah, she had it. Mm-hmm. Other people have it, but, you know, she had had a premonition that something was wrong.
So, I'm not knocking the situation of what happened, but I'm just trying to understand this myself a little bit. Your sister, it was Took, right?
Tookie.
Tookie. Please forgive. Drove from Louisiana to West Virginia with her boyfriend.
I'll give you the story.
So
the boyfriend, his name was Sean Cole.
What you could tell within reason on everything.
Well, so. It's in the film.
Yeah,
I mean,
I, you know,
there's nothing.
Right.
You know,
I just want to be respectful and
right. Yeah, you're cool. They both had become addicted to the opiates. They both had problems with the opiates. They had gotten in trouble here in, I think, Virginia. They were wanted. They have warrants out. He had stolen checks from a pool company. So they were essentially fleeing justice from this area. And they had showed up at my grandfather's. And he had taken them in. And, you know, he was trying to help them. We're not sure of a lot of the specifics of what happens with the altercation. But they have went down there to get away from getting in trouble here. And there, things just obviously got worse. The murder actually takes place in Louisiana. They wrap my grandfather's body in trash bags and bring it up here, and they hide it in Jaredstown. And we talked earlier about Mary, this woman who lived in Jaredstown. She saw Sean Cole in the woods burying my grandfather's body. So she's the woman who reveals to the authorities that this body's there. And it's not too long after the body's discovered that, you know, we figure out that they're involved because the police are looking for my sister.
And I think one of the other questions that I had, because I don't think I'm not knocking you, Don, at all. Was there a charge of murder too, or
first? They're both charged initially with first degree murder. She's convicted of second degree murder. He's convicted of second degree murder. She serves a decade in prison.
11 years.
Mm-hmm. 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
She was released when?
2015, September of 2015, I believe.
2015.
Yeah.
So she's served her time. She's done what society told her she had to do. He remains incarcerated. I don't know for how much longer, but he'll get out too, but I'm just not sure when.
No, I know that he did receive, I think, 25 years. Yeah, so.
Longer than her.
Yeah.
Because it seemed, again, I'm not knocking you down, because the documentary kind of ended, it didn't really seem like there was a trial, or at the time it was going to trial, or
yeah,
it didn't, you
I'm
know,
not,
at that
I'm,
time.
I'm not
so.
Even sure how it ends, but it does end with, of course, with open-ended questions.
Right.
And I remember a friend of mine named Skiz Sazik, great filmmaker from Baltimore, he said he always felt like it wasn't finished. But, you know, it had to be fucking done. I was done. You know,
right.
And
they hadn't gone to trial.
It's
got to
go. Right. I don't think they did.
No.
And they don't go to trial. They both end up accepting it's plea deals, right? To the lesser charge of second degree with the opportunity to get out of prison.
So I know with Earl here, everybody that is in attendance has seen the film. Has Tookie seen this?
Yes, he has.
And do you know her thoughts in regards to this, or
she,
that you're willing to say?
Yeah,
so.
No, actually, Tookie and I spoke today, and she knew that, you know, I was coming here, you know, to meet Dee, and that, you know, this was happening, and she knows that Dee is showing the film. She did see it, and she has no interest in seeing it again, and she's quiet about it. You know, she's quiet about the film, but she watched it all the way through.
I saw her for the first time just a couple of weeks ago. We had talked, I think, once or twice on the telephone prior to that, a lot of tears. But the first meeting was awesome and deepest hug I'd had in you know, forever. You know, and she's done what she's supposed to do. She served her time. You know, we've all suffered from this, and that you just hope that no more. You know what I'm saying? No more. That you find you don't want the chaos.
Mm-mm, no.
You don't want to damage. You don't want to hurt. You know, you just...
Some point in time, I just feel like, you know, mentally you need to, with stuff like this, for me anyway, you know, I had to find an end, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, for lack
Absolutely.
Of better, you know.
Absolutely.
And I feel like I did.
Absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely.
Because we've had a long time to, you know, process this. And this, if I didn't, you know, process it the way I did, and it took years. I pretty much ran every single day. I ran almost every single day for many years. Even after it sleet or it snowed, my thing was running, and it was a lot of beautiful things happened in my brain during the running, mm-hmm. and processing being one of it. But you know, for me, you know, closure, your 10th anniversary, and
right.
I had to bring closure with that too.
Right. Yeah.
You
yeah.
know?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And to say that, you know, no matter what the tragic situations that befall us in our lives, they're worth surviving. That's you know, that's ultimately in a nutshell. And you want to take from these things that you survive some type of moral message that mm-hmm. you can pass on to others.
And not hate. I refuse to take hate. And you know, I have no hate.
And it's fascinating how you're talking about your anger, because, you know, same as you. We all grew up in the same environment. I had the same poor coping skills. I had a horrible fucking temper. Mm-hmm. And every now and then, rare, man, but my temper will come out. I remember flipping a table not too long ago. It was the first time I'd acted like that in years. It takes a lot to fuck me up, push my buttons, but I calmed myself down. I stopped it. You know, I got it under control. I hate feeling that, you know, but so it makes when people fuck up a little bit more understanding. Like, it dwells in all of us. It dwells mm-hmm. in all of us. That making a mistake, crossing a line, losing control, you know, anything from drunk driving and you kill someone, it could be countless things. You know, that the impact that one person can have on, take Las Vegas, man. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
One fucked up crazy
yeah.
guy with a fucking gun fucked up all them families. Virginia Tech, one crazy man, you know. Columbine, one crazy person. Sandy Hook. So at any time, these kind of things can befall anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you talk about this.
Right.
We survived a tragedy. It can be done.
I was one of the things I was going to ask, but the prior discussion with Earl and everybody else kind of filled in the question of updates, what happened, kind of like an epilogue. So I'm going to kind of pass on that for right now. We are about an hour, a hair over an hour and 10
minutes. We can wrap.
So we could wrap about this up. So,
are you happy?
I am happy. I think all in all.
Again, the program is Saturday, 1 week from tonight, October 21st, Area 31 in downtown Frederick, Maryland. They are online and have a fantastic web page.
Okay.
7 o'clock.
If this drops prior, then I hope you all could. Is there a cost or is it?
Absolutely free.
It's free to join, so come on down and join. Don will be there.
Sister.
And
Marie
is going to be there.
Maria.
Again, I apologize. if not, if it drops the day before and I use it as the supplementary for it, I hope you enjoyed this. I hope those who did show up, I hope you enjoyed the experience. I know I'll probably be there and hitching a ride with Don to be a part of it full out and everything else. It'll be enjoyable to see everybody again. So there's that. I'm going to stop it, and I'm going to fill in down what I'm going to do with the kind of the prelims of everything. So while it's encoding, so you guys take care and enjoy your week and everything else. Till then, later.
Welcome back, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that little Q&A session, that this quasi-panel supplementary thing. If you have your own questions in reference to if you watched the movie, again, the links will be to it from YouTube, will be everywhere. If you're listening to this, they will be in the description below. If you have your questions of your own that were not included in this little Q&A type of ordeal, or because you weren't able to go to the event, please email us at longcoatmafia@gmail.com, or if you watched the movie, please leave the questions in the comments for the movie that's on YouTube, or like I say, you can email us at longcoatmafia@gmail.com, or leave us a message on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/TheLongCoatMafiaPodcast. And I'll pass them along to Don Ramirez. While you're on our Facebook page, please click that like button so you're able to stay tuned for new updates. If you want to follow us on Instagram and Twitter, it's the same handle, which is Long Coat Mafia. Please follow us there. I do tend to be a little bit more social there and with our social media, plus other aspects of it. And plus, what else? We are available on iTunes/Apple Podcasts, plus Google Play Music. So please click subscribe there and follow us. That way you get the episodes as instantly that they're officially dropped. Because once they're dropped, it takes a day or two for them to show up on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, and Google Play Music. So that's that. What else? I'm forgetting something. It'll come to me sometime else. So either way, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please stay tuned for a whole mess of other things. For a little bit of a preview, next week's episode will be a solo rant episode. So expect a lot of bitterness or some more fun than what was last week in our downer type of episode. So stay tuned, stick with us, good things are coming. So, and if you want to hear more about Don stuff or other, please contact us again at longcoatmafia@gmail.com. We are always open to your responses and critiques. So there's that, and I'm out.
See you next time on the Long Coat Mafia.